We have been having Julia Cameron's prayers from a non-believer sort of serve as our guide into opening different considerations for the past weeks. And so I want to read you the prayer from her book that I chose to get us underway this morning. Dear God, I have an ulterior motive with these prayers. I am hoping to attain something of an overview, a broader perspective. But I'm thinking that if I could attain what is probably called faith, I might have an easier time of things, a sneaking optimism, a suspicion that maybe everything will work out after all. Living in the city makes that harder, I think. There's the everyday crush, of course, but there's also the fact that cities seem to be about what humans have made, and the rest of creation gets marginalized. I mean, an Omaha farmer, this next bit's funny to me just because Omaha's is, you know, kind of the wild farmlands for Cameron who lives in New York, and I'm looking around our land when I read this. And anyway, an Omaha farmer watches a field go cold and dead and gray. Omaha in winter is a hellish place. How long is winter in Omaha? Anyway, Omaha in winter is a hellish place, but then spring. Little green shoots, bigger green shoots, corn. Pardon the pun, God, but something as corny as corn can make you trust that life has more up its sleeve than the apparent wintry disaster of the moment. I mean, there must be a balance. At least as much beauty and hope in this world as disaster, but we don't focus on that. The evening news is not good. But it's not the whole story either. My thought is that maybe you hold a larger view than CNN. That's why I'm trying to tune into you instead. Is there a you? Some of you were here at our gathering earlier in Lent when I mentioned that the word Lent is basically an older form for our word length. Like the way the word length would sound if you had a head cold. As in, I think I cut this board to the right length. Did you hear Lent in there? Length. That's where the word Lent comes from. Lengthening, the lengthening of days. It's a word for spring. It's a word that says this is the time of the year when the frozen field begins to thaw. And the season of Lent is in the calendar where it is, in no small part because the folks that put it into place were surfing the wave of things that were already in place in the surrounding culture. And in particular, marking the lengthening of the daylight hours in spring, which to the people who established Lent in the time when they did, was an incredibly important and welcome shift after a long winter. And it wasn't just kind of like, and Sasha and I were talking about this just a few minutes ago, about how March is this non-season. It'd be kind of nice to skip it in some ways, except that the days are lengthening. Spring is coming. It seems like a long time to say spring is coming. Could it, any time now would be awesome, right? But it's still starting to happen. And that's for people who don't generally live with this conscious sense of connection and dependence to the land. One of my kids is one of their courses, which they're very much enjoying in university right now, is an Indigenous Studies course, and they'd just written an exam, and Kale tends to want to be well prepared for exams and generally is and generally does well. This is a multiple choice exam. Class has 100 students in it. It's a survey class. And so he says, I'm sitting there and I'm filling out the exam. And he says, you know, it's an interesting experience, Dad, because he said, like, the right answer on an Indigenous Studies exam is land. Like, the right answer in Sunday school is Jesus. Like, what's the answer to this question in Indigenous values? Well, the answer is land. And I came in this morning and I'm looking at what's on the board and, you know, top corner, land. Right? And so it's the theme was his point. He wasn't being unkind or inconsiderate. He was just acknowledging this. And he said, I could look around at people filling in this multiple choice exam, and I knew they were doing it wrong. Like, I knew that they didn't know the answers, because you can see. Like, it's not, you know, it would be super easy to cheat in this setting. And I'm thinking, like, if you just went down all the questions and filled in land, you'd probably do better than you're doing right now. That sense of connection to the land is something that most of us in this room don't have that way. In a way that we would answer a fundamental existential or cosmological question with land. The way that if we grew up in a Christian setting, people tended to answer with Jesus. I'm not making a one-to-one correlation, but I'm talking about the presence of the strength of the value. So most of us we've lost sight of the origins in some ways of that connection these days because we don't live with this conscious dependence, which is what Cameron was talking about in the prayer that I read. So on from there though, because we are surrounded by all kinds of reminders of how much this connection matters, and also we're surrounded by reminders of how deeply informed our notions of God are by our own linkage to creation and creator. And if your spiritual path includes paying attention to the Hebrew sacred texts, which probably lots of us in this room would simply think of as the Old Testament, which is kind of interesting, also easy to lose sight of the fact that these are another religion's sacred texts in the main. If we pay attention to the Hebrew sacred texts and especially the Psalms, there are lots of reminders there of the connection between creation and creator. Here's a for instance, this would be familiar in some ways, Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim God's work. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim God's work. If you're one of those people in this gathering who likes to look up every biblical reference I make on your phone just to make sure I haven't modified it in some heretical way, you're going to love this next part. I did modify it, and I'm not sorry. Do I sound like a five-year-old yet? I want to tell you about this, not because I feel like a mea culpa is required, but because I think it can point us somewhere potentially helpful. My drive into the city, most days, takes me past John Black United Church and on Henderson. And they have a signboard, which in my opinion they managed to keep blessedly, mostly free of cheesy church wit sayings. What's been on there for a few weeks now is an ad for a lunch hour Bible study with the title, "That Was Then, This Is Now," with a question mark at the end. And the question mark is sort of because of the space taken by the text, the question mark is sort of tucked just almost under the flange of the sign. And for the first couple of weeks, I didn't notice it. I didn't notice that it was a question. I thought it was a statement. The question mark's at the end of the sign, and to me what it did is it sort of shifted something. Because essentially what that sign says to me is that if I'm someone that reads the Bible or is even somewhat aware of the stories that it contains, and I find myself thinking, that's an ancient document, and I don't see how it could possibly have anything to say to anybody in the 21st century, the question of whether that's the case or not becomes an open one once it's an interrogative, once it's a question rather than a statement. And that, it seems to me, has a lot more potential for good than either concluding that it can't possibly have anything to say to the here and now or to declaring that it's the only true guide to faith and life, both of which are pretty commonly held positions. And let's just be honest about this. The Bible is a collection of ancient texts, and there are things about it that are problematic. Since we're talking about the Psalms, let's take the Psalms, for instance. The Psalms are, among other things, probably one of the most beloved prayer books in human history. They cover a lot of ground. They cover a lot of different spiritual moods and issues. And a lot of what constitutes Christian spirituality is drawn from the Psalms, which is kind of interesting, given that they're Hebrew texts. I do understand the connection. I just think we forget it once in a while, so I keep mentioning it. But there's also a lot to wrestle with. I recently ran across the writings of a woman named Christine Robinson, someone who wasn't familiar with me, whose reflections on the Psalms have been really illuminating for me. And a lot of the sort of compact insightfulness of the list of problems in the Psalms that I'm going to talk about in a moment, I would credit to her. When we read the Psalms in the 21st century, it's easy to not attend to the problems with them. But let's just start here. The Psalms were written within a patriarchal society. They assume the masculinity of God. They assume the masculinity of the world's leaders. And they assume the masculinity of the reader. That leaves a lot of people out. And even as a male, I can tell you that the thought of God as gendered seems at best absurd to me and more often actually abusive and hurtful. So if you looked up that Psalm 19 piece that we read just a moment ago, You most likely will have seen a translation that says something like, "The heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands." Hence the unapologetic modification. The Psalms were also written to people that were living in a threatened monarchy. And we live in what Robinson says she experiences as a threatening democracy. I could dismiss that just by adding she's American, but I think that would be selling the challenges of our own democracy a little short. That means, among other things, that if we want to look at sacred text to inform our imagination about what the divine picture of a good nation is, and a lot of the Psalms deal with that theme, then we need a different slant. We need a different basic assumption. Because the slant from which the psalmist writes about the divine picture of a good society is answering the question, how do you live into a good culture when the starting point is that you are part of a tribal group whose monarchy is threatened? And that's a different question than how do you live into a good society when your starting point is a democracy that doesn't always behave like its ideal. So that's important. The Psalms are also works that reflect the science of their time. And it's not that they don't reflect on the world around them in the way that science does. They do. They just do it in a manner that's consistent with the writer's experience of that and their knowledge of it. So we know some things about the universe and about its ongoing creation that the psalmists couldn't possibly know, and we need to take those things into account. Psalms are not a good basis for constructing our view of the nature of the universe. But they might do an awesome job of stirring our imagination about the presence of the divine in the universe that we are still discovering. They reflect the science of their time. And the Psalms have something that Robinson calls uneven spiritual content. Which I think is a very kind turn of phrase. You might be familiar with some of the Psalms' portrayal of God as a violent being. A particularly memorable image that often gets mentioned in this context is the Psalm that talks about, God bashing babies' brains out on rocks, which is, any way you look at it, a gruesomely violent image. And the way some people approach those texts is they psychologize them. You know, haven't you ever felt angry enough to want to bash somebody's baby's brains out on a rock? Well, no. I hear what you're saying, but no. And furthermore, my power to do so is limited, and you're talking about describing a being whose power to do so would not be limited. So I think it's important to recognize those kind of texts for what they are, which is the projection of the human onto the divine. So we've talked about that idea here quite a bit. Why thinking about God as a super person is a bad idea. I am so incensed with our enemies that I want to bash their kids' brains out on a rock, and God is on my side, so that means God wants me to do this, so the violence, this particular violence is okay because it's sanctioned by the divine, is not an okay way to think about God. How often do I say something like that here? That is not okay. I feel confident about that. But what's the alternative? How about this? How about we try owning our own emotions and applying that when we read the Psalms and see where that takes us? How about we try owning our own stuff instead of handing it off to the divine and see where that takes us? One more. The world in which the Psalms were written absolutely assumes the existence of God. The world in which we live does not. To choose faith in God in whatever form it takes for us in the postmodern, never mind post-Christian West, is to know that we are choosing something that we cannot ultimately defend, that at some level we are choosing something that does not match the baseline assumptions of the surrounding culture. So for the psalmist to talk about the absence of God, where are you? I'm suffering. How come I can't hear you? How come I can't feel you? How come you feel like you're far away? Is a completely different matter, because it starts with the baseline assumption that God is there, than to have that same experience if you actually live in a world where that is not the working assumption. If you are facing a sense of the absence of the experience of the divine, but your baseline assumption is that God is there, you are having a different experience than if you are experiencing that sense of standing on the edge of the void, and one of the real possibilities to you is that there is nothing there. That is not the same space. Why are we having an epidemic of despair? I would contend that one of the reasons is because that's a real existential dilemma of our time. Because when you stand on the brink of nothing, you are in a different place than when you stand on the brink of what does this particular silence mean? When your core belief is it's temporary. Not the same thing. But the Psalms assume, boilerplate, that God exists. So bringing postmodern and other non-traditional ways of thinking about God into conversation with the Psalms or with any of the other biblical texts requires a bit of work. And there's more than one way to do that. If we move out of the box of that particular ancient culture for a bit and we look to an ancient culture closer to home, that of this continent's First Nations, we find both a rich heritage and current practices of connection to creation and creator. I heard some folks discussing the video we're going to watch in just a moment the other day, and when I looked it up for myself, I immediately knew that I wanted us all to have a chance to see it. I want to be very careful with this particular piece because this now I'm right on the line of cultural appropriation. I want to encourage us to watch this with respect. I want to encourage us to watch it with an open mind and an open heart. I want us to encourage us to ask the question, what might we learn from this young man's personal perspective and his passion and his practice? I am not suggesting that what you're about to see is something that should be subsumed or assimilated, the way that our culture has often used that word around, in particular, the experience of settler interaction with First Nations folks. Well, so just going to take us a wee moment to get this set up, and then we can watch it together.
Hello, my name is Jack O'Brien Jr. I live in Iwamiskan, Ontario. I'm Cree and proud to be. I live along the James Bay shorelines, the lowlands, and the Musquehanna territory. My message to you, you're having a hard time up to the trees, as it shows you to stand tall and proud. Up to the rock, as it shows you the strength you need. Up to the river, as it shows you to keep moving forward in life, as it flows and can never give up. To the flowers, as it shows you the love you need, the colors, the grass, as it teaches you forgiveness, as it always grows and grows no matter if you keep stepping on it. It's there to show you to forgive. Be matter. Every little thing matters. The trees, the rocks, flowers, you matter. Stay strong.
I probably watched that 20 times, and by the end of it, I can't breathe every time. It's just like, oh yeah, that's right. That's true, don't you think? You know, the psalmist knew that it was true. That's why the trees did things like clapping their hands. That's why the heavens did things like proclaim. That's why there is nothing, if we continued in Psalm 19, that has been made that does not speak about Creator. Every living thing matters. I think for Jack Linklater Jr., the intersection between the ancient and the contemporary is alive and well, but it takes some work to keep it that way. Two weekends ago, all of our family was at home. That doesn't happen very often. It almost never happens without a lot of advanced planning, but this time it just did, and we were all there. It's a beautiful day, so we decided to go for a walk. And Kayla, Kale's partner, Kayla has this quite active, embodied sense of connection to the world around her. I think her email includes the words tree hugger, if I'm not mistaken. And she also has a really well-informed theology of place. And so these things kind of came together for me. And we were out for this walk, and we're walking down the road, and Kayla, true to form, was sort of skipping down the road, like just whole body having the experience of this beautiful early spring day. And all of a sudden, she just stopped, and she kind of looked around, and she said, "Hey, we don't just live in houses. We live in a world." It was just a sense of, woohoo, you know, we're getting out. I remember when we lived in the city, what this was like. And all of a sudden, it was like, neighbors, right? In the spring, we have neighbors. They're still alive. This is good. And all of a sudden, everybody's out on the street with their coffee cup, you know, watching their kids ride through the puddles or whatever they're doing in the neighborhood. But they're out. We're back. We don't just live in houses. We live in a world. And if we lose sight of that, we potentially lose our grip on one of the most important truths about what it means to be human, which is that we are inextricably connected to the earth, made of the dust, the Hebrew poets tell us, made of the stardust, our own science tells us. And Lent, the season of the lengthening of days, provides the perfect reminder at the perfect time to attend to pay attention to what matters the most, including this connection to the earth and our responsibility to care for our home. We are, from a Christian theological vantage point, among other things, the only part of the work of Creator that makes worlds of the earth. And I'm not going to go into all the ways you can nuance those terms, but they're important terms. Other parts of creation make abodes or homes. But alone among what Creator has made and what has come from that moment in creation, we humans make worlds of the earth. Hey, we don't just live in homes. We live in a world. One of the things that can help us pay attention, as we've talked about several times over Lent, is to either stop doing something familiar or to start doing something new, to put something down or to take something up. In other words, it's to do something new with something we already know. And I spend a lot of my time surrounded by musicians, and increasingly, because of Davis's work, by theater people. In the worlds of music and theater, to make something new with something we already know is called improvisation. A good short definition of improvisation is that to improvise is to use a theme in a way that is recognizable but fresh. To use a theme in a way that is recognizable but fresh. So here's what I want to invite us to do together this morning, just to kind of get the ball rolling. I'm going to read an improvisation on a familiar psalm. It's a psalm that is about our relationship to Creator and creation, and about our part in caring for creation. I want us to be conscious as I'm reading this that it is a prayer. And so in listening to this actively, we are also praying, which in almost any tradition is understood to be addressing ourselves to the divine. If you want to check out the original, this is based on Psalm 8. Who are we? Many named one, beyond imagining. When I contemplate the night sky, the cosmos, which all unfolded from a speck, galaxies, stars, this beautiful earth. Who are we humans that you attend to us? Mere mortals in our tiny corner, and you love us. We our life, come to knowing and feeling. The whole world is in our hands. Plants and animals, oceans and ice caps, rainforests, atmosphere and ecosystem. Touch our hearts, O God. Make us worthy of this trust. Help us care for life on this beautiful earth. I'm going to read it for us one more time. Many named one, beyond imagining, when I contemplate the night sky, the cosmos, which all unfolded from a speck, galaxies, stars, this beautiful earth, who are we humans that you attend to us, mere mortals in our tiny corner, and you love us? We are life, come to knowing and feeling. The whole world is in our hands. Plants and animals, oceans and ice caps, rainforests, atmosphere and ecosystem. Touch our hearts, O God. Make us worthy of this trust. Help us care for life on this beautiful earth. I don't know about you. I can live pretty happily in the land of ideas and forget that unless I do something with them, because the ideas feel fairly rich and satisfying to me, that if I don't do something with them, I'm really not using the agency that I have when it comes to the kind of world in which we live. So, once again, not heroic, as we've talked about several times throughout Lent. This isn't an invitation to heroism. It's an invitation to things that we could actually do. But here's our homework this morning and going out from here. Two questions for us to consider. You won't have to talk about these in our gathering, but you'll have an opportunity to if you want. First of all, a simple question that when I've asked it to other people turned out not to be so simple. So I might expand on it just a little bit. The way I wrote it down is the question, what part of the whole world is in my hands, in your hands? And I think the reason people get stumped on the question when they do, it seems to me in groups, is because they want to make the scope of it too big. No, I'm actually talking about the stuff that you materially, physically put your hands on. What part of the whole world will you leave here this morning and deal with directly in a way in which you have agency? So let me give you a couple of examples. Whether I let my car idle when I could turn it off is within my hands. We know there's a connection between that car idling and the world in which we live. The science is not ambiguous. What I drink the water that my body needs out of is within my hands. Whether it's a disposable plastic bottle or a usable bottle. So that's the question. But make it personal, because the instances I've offered might be like, yeah, whatever. They might not connect for you at all. So just take a couple of moments and ask yourself the question, what is it about this whole world that I can easily kind of envision as within my hands? And having thought of such a thing, perhaps you thought of 20 such things, I'd invite you to pick one if you're able. The second question is simply, what can I do each day? Dailiness. We've talked about this before here. What can I do each day to care for that part? What's the choice over which I have agency? And even if we understand agency as a slippery thing, something that we experience as humans but that might not be quite as whole-bodied as we think it is, that might be partly, maybe largely about perception, even if we think of it that way, when you walk out of here this morning, you are going to do things. Some of them you could do different. Some of them I could do different. Each day, what is some choice that you could make, that I could make, to care for that thing that is within our hands, within your hands? So we're going to leave that there. Just one last idea. I know this is one of those mornings that feels like I tried to put my arms around too much. Does that ever happen any other time? Anyone who showed up this morning wondering if the table was a place that would pay attention to the fact that in the traditional Christian calendar today is Palm Sunday, which is not what I've been talking about. I want to make the linkage explicit because it's been perking along in the background the entire time. Paying attention to what matters often puts us in places where we realize things have to change, that the way that they are operating cannot stay as status quo. And for me, that is one of the most obvious ways to understand the story of Palm Sunday. A story, if you don't happen to stand in that tradition or you're not kind of making the linkage because it's not what you've been thinking about, the Palm Sunday story at the centerpiece, of course, has Jesus riding into the occupied capital, the threatened monarchy experience on full volume, riding into the occupied capital of his nation on the colt of a donkey, just to make the point that it was not a war horse, writ large or writ small, as the case may be, clearly sending the symbolic message that although business as usual was not the way forward, the path to change was not collective violence, but collective attention to living differently, to a different perspective on what was all around all the people every day. There you go. My 1 minute Palm Sunday sermon. So that might be worth a try. We all have to decide. But I think that paying attention to our connections, to what is around us, and to how we can nurture those connections in nonviolent and loving ways, and then attend to what grows, might be an excellent path forward. Only you can figure that out. So over to you. Peace.